Let me close by being optimistic about our ability to invest in innovation, science, and competitiveness here in the United States. If we look back at what happened when the Soviets launched the Sputnik satellite, it was a moment that was a genuine wake-up call for the American people. And as a result, Congress and the administration invested in STEM education, invested in research and in fundamental and applied science. And the benefits of that lasted for two generations. January 6th was a moment that was challenging, divisive, difficult for all of us here in Congress. And it was a wake-up call that our country is badly divided. And the ways in which China has become a peer competitor in investing in R&D, in the number of patents issued, the number of research papers published, and the ways in which they are now trying to take the lead in standard essential, standard setting bodies. That recent campaign to put a Chinese national at the head of the WIPO, where the PTO director, Andre Iancu, was did yeoman's work to make sure that someone committed to a strong intellectual property system globally instead became the head of the WIPO. All of this is a wake-up call for us that we need to have another Sputnik-like moment of reinvestment in American innovation and competitiveness. A central part of being successful in this competition is continuing with our constitutionally created protected property right of a patent, something I've long believed in, and I look forward to hearing how you're contributing to working to strengthen and sustain a competitive, strong global IP system, both here in the United States and around the world. So thank you, Dr. Hamri. Thank you to CSIS, and if you will forgive me, I need to run back upstairs and cast another
bet. You know, many senators simply represent their state, but a few senators lead the nation. You are a national leader. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Doctor. It's great being on with you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. You just heard from United States Senator from Pfizer. Later in the show, we're going to be joined by Luke Savage to talk about why the world doesn't really need Bill Gates or Big Pharma either. My name is David Griscom, broadcasting to you live from Austin, Texas, joined as always by my friend and comrade, Matt Leck, where we will be breaking down what's going on in Colombia, talking a little bit about IP and this vaccine apartheid, and also a little bit of a recap and breakdown as to what happened in Austin with this anti-homeless Prop B that unfortunately passed. But we'll get to all that in just a little bit. How's it going, Matt?
It's going okay, David. I had a spoof of what Coons just said. What that guy said to Coons, few senators represent their states, but you lead. It's like, how about
you lead the nation?
Yeah, how about stick to representing like the people of Delaware, Chris? would be my advice. But I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right, David. David and I are covering the vaccines, and it's not only because we're on the business end of the second dose. David, I hope you're David's closer to it than I am. I hope you're doing all right.
Man, I think everybody should get the vaccine, and but I will say the second dose knocked me out. And not just for a little bit, for about 2 days. I was worried that I wasn't going to be able to do the show tonight. But I'm coming back to life, just a little bit paler and slower than normal. Yeah. But I don't know, man, like, it's so funny how all these people feel like you have to lie about this stuff. Like, look, it sucks. And not everybody gets the side effects. I mean, I know plenty of people who didn't. I got hit really hard with it. I think Matt's going through it a little bit too.
Yeah, well, you hear that women, I had always been hearing that women got it worse than men, and my girlfriend didn't really get it that bad at all, and I got nailed by it. I do not like feeling that fever, the feeling of I'm too hot, so let me, shed some blankets or whatever. Oh, crap, now I'm freezing. Like, that back and forth is bad one, but you know what, worth it.
Yeah, no, it's definitely worth it. But it, yeah, you know, it's just one of those things, because all these people act like you have to lie about it and not tell people the truth. And it's like, hey, man, it might suck a little bit, but it's a small price to pay to have immunity and also to make sure this thing doesn't spread amongst your Tony family Fauci, the community.
Yeah, if Tony Fauci's little mask early on in the pandemic didn't put the lie to that, like, let's lie about this stuff. Got to be honest with folks, I think. Mm-hmm. And you know, hopefully some more enough trust can be built in this country and the world. I mean, firstly, this country, because the world isn't going to get enough vaccines for this to be a question, but like to get herd immunity, you know, people should be encouraged to get the shots. But yeah, you know, it's going to put you down maybe.
Yeah. No, exactly. And yeah, we're going to talk a bit about the vaccines more, and also how it's absurd that the United States has had such a monopoly over them for so long. But before we do that, we wanted to cover what's happening in Colombia right now, because it's a really important moment. And it also shows for our American listeners, even and our European listeners, how prepared the like US media system is to manufacture consent on these things, and how they're very selective on these questions. So for folks who are not familiar, there have been protests against poverty and a extremely draconian tax plan across the country of Colombia. And it has been met with severe police and military crackdown. And, you know, we're talking actual deaths in the street, firing live rounds at people, extreme overreaction to folks who are standing up against a very, very unfair tax plan, which we'll get into in a second. So far, 24 people are dead, 87 people are missing, and many, many, many more are injured. The protests started really with a general strike on April 28th, and they are in response to these proposed regressive taxes, which the government, run by President Duque, who is a big-time right-winger, a good friend of Bolsonaro, somebody who, you know, there have been many reports, has privately made promises that he would be interested in supporting a U.S. coup against Venezuela, right? He put forward these extremely regressive taxes that were mislabeled as a solidarity tax or solidarity law. And basically what this plan was meant to do was to increase revenue for the state by, they said, taxing the rich. But of course, they filled it with so many loopholes that the vast majority of the wealthy would be A-OK, as in addition to international corporations, the 1%. Y'all know the script there. But they called a solidarity tax, again, you know, in this kind of misnomer, but to make this idea is like, you know, everybody has to step up a little bit. Where the real meat of this tax was focused on was people to the of the lower middle class, through increases in taxes against their income. But where it got extremely regressive was with the VAT, the value added tax, which meant for most people, there would be an increase in taxes on everyday staple foods, you know, everyday goods that you need to survive, oil, things of that nature, right? So this is the kind of classic tax when you come after spending in general in a country. That means that you're going to come after the vast majority of economic activity in the country. And when you live in a country that has extreme poverty and inequality, it means it's going to be an extremely regressive tax. Remember, this is a tax you know, that we fight against a lot in the United States, but was proposed by the looking like potentially future Bitcoin mayor of New York City, Andrew Yang, right? These taxes can be extremely, extremely regressive. But people rose up across the board, led in large parts by unions, and we've seen protests across the country, not just focused in a few different cities. So there's a general strike on April 28th and another one on May 5th. And again, it has been hit with the most brutal state violence crackdown.
Yeah, it's something to see helicopters meant for, like, presumably the drug war, ostensibly, mm-hmm. being used to, cower a population into accepting regressive taxes and austerity.
And, No, and it's one of those things where this was like, you know, to use a cliche, sorry, I'm still a little bit messed up from my shot, but, you know, it's the straw that broke the camel's back. And yes, Duque, they have pulled back the tax, right? They aren't going to go forward with it, but people are still in the streets because they are protesting the extreme inequality and poverty and devastation that they have faced because of this right-wing government's rule. I just wanted to note two things. And in the last section of this, Matt and I are going to focus on how this has been covered in the U.S., right? Particularly how, you know, the OAS and the U.S., even though they've, you know, they've made their condemnations, because of course you have to condemn it when police are killing people in the streets. It's been very tempered compared to what the United States and the OAS were saying in Bolivia. And we'll get to why that matters in a second. But I also wanted to hit on another aspect. So yes, the government in Colombia is right wing. This is Chicago boy style stuff, right? Cut spending, cut the deficit at the sacrifice of working class and poor people, right? This is a script we all know very, very well. But why is there such a deep rooted desire to push down the deficit and enforce austerity in the midst of a pandemic in that country? It's because, yes, we can say all the things about the government, bad guy, right-wing ideology, all that other kind of stuff. But there is a dependency on international foreign investment. And what do international investors want? They want IMF-imposed, you know, one package fits all, austerity regimes in order for them to invest money into a country. We saw the same thing earlier in the pandemic in Argentina, right? Under a completely different context. Right. But again, this is just another example about how these questions aren't just questions about left and right, even. And again, this isn't supporting Duque or anything like that. It's saying that there is a fundamental lack of democracy when access to investment is controlled in an elite, a wealthy elite, right? Even if it's just in your own country, but it's even more exceptional when it's a wealthy elite outside of your country.
Yeah. Who should we get to? Which world leader should we get to first, Marco Rubio or Evo Morales?
Let's start with little Marco here.
Okay, so little Marco, and I'll make this big for you, David. But he says this: behind much of the violence occurring in Colombia, he uses the hashtags. He's online. This week is an orchestrated effort to destabilize a democratically elected government by left-wing narco-guerrilla movements and their international Marxist allies. Now, he doesn't actually specify Maduro here, but I've seen other, right-wingers say that this is, you know, Maduro. Well, has fingerprints all over this.
I mean, it's so funny, too, when they use the terms democratically elected and when they don't, right? We've in the past couple of years have experienced a few questions where the idea of where we were using the phrase democratically elected that were proven in the claims of fraud against them were proven to be absolutely false.
Right.
And in this case, of course, you know, using the specter of Venezuela is not only useful for Marco Rubio, but it's what they do in Colombia and it's what they do in Brazil as well. And I think the point that we want to make here is that it's funny when they freak out about these kind of arguments about Venezuela, right? Where again, Maduro wins the election. Chavez wins the election, right? You might disagree with policies. There might be issues that you have with it, right? But these are two democratically elected governments, right? Marco Rubio has no problem with, supporting the dopey Guaido in that scenario. But not when it comes to, but when it comes to Colombia, they're democratically elected governments. And this is just an example that is so strikingly clear, the hypocrisy of it.
And it was nice drawn in the article we should move to now quickly before we go to Luke by Ken Klippenstein and Ryan Grimm in Intercept about the DOJ harassing MIT and CEPR researchers for calling out the OAS fraud claims at the time using like math that was people were doing on Twitter. And people talk about like it was great to have Twitter there, but it was also great to have these researchers and this institutional voice saying, hey, wait a second. The analogy Ken and Ryan drew in the Intercept piece was to Trump's attempt on the election in our country, which is the exact same thing, which is you try to call the election before everything can be counted, particularly the parts of the country that don't vote for you. And that's exactly what the OAS tried. And yeah, it's funny that.
I think, though, like, you know, I talked about this on the Griscom stream on Tuesday, but I just really want to highlight this again to people. Because one, and, you know, this is not just trying to settle scores or anything like that, but there was a time on the U.S. left, even when saying what happened was happening in Bolivia was a coup was not a popular statement. And there was a lot of fence sitting going on during this. Right. And, you know, we were covering it. But other than that, there was honestly a lot of people being pro coup who call themselves left wing. But again, I do think that people should, you know, do a little bit of reflection if that was the position that they took. But one of the things that was so critical in shifting this narrative was when you started to see these statistical analyses that were coming out of CEPR and out of MIT. And I just want to say it again so nobody mishears it or it doesn't sink into their head. In response to this, the Bolivian coup government called up the United States Department of Justice and encouraged them to ask questions to these MIT statisticians, right? Which there is no other way to frame this other than intimidation, right? Intimidation of folks who, from the reports I was reading in The Intercept, were very confused at first because the DOJ lawyer kept on calling it Paraguay instead of Bolivia. And that's a funny note, right? And we can, like, it's funny that the DOJ is sloppy, right? But that should not make people think that this was not a serious attempt to stifle criticism, and should not, and should also highlight to folks who, again, are still fence sitting on this other fundamental fact that the coup in Bolivia had U.S. support and backing. This should be just another prime example that that is true. And no amount of fact checks in the New York Times, Washington Post against Evo Morales on this question can bury the truth on this one.
Yeah. What other institutions come to mind when it comes to the question of the Bolivian election? Like CEPR and those MIT researchers were, unless there were others that I'm forgetting, like that's probably the main one. So that the DIJ is harassing them says an awful lot, I think, about, yeah, I mean, This is a story that needs to be emphasized quite a lot, I think.
Yeah. And yeah. And I think too, just like looking at the difference in how the initial reaction to what was happening in Bolivia, how that was covered in U.S. media and obviously by U.S. officials versus what's happening in Colombia is covered. Even the way that it's being covered by like CNN, New York Times, is almost as if like, oh, there's no prehistory to the protests. Right. They're actually trying to frame it as like, oh, this is just what's happening in Latin America. There's a lot of anger. Right. Instead of actually tying it to why people in Colombia are fed up with this right wing and now terroristic state. I just think a big part of the show focuses on that part of the world, because you will never see as much hypocrisy in U.S. media than the way that they just blatantly lie and bury facts when it comes to the reporting in South America.
Yeah. All right, folks, we'll be right back with Luke Savage. We'll be right back. Folks, we are back. Matt Leck with David Griscom, Left Reckoning, joined by Luke Savage. He's a staff writer at Jacobin. You can also see his words in Current Affairs, The Atlantic, The Guardian, and The New Statesman. Luke, hello.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you for joining us. I was just admiring the CN Tower out the window there. I'm familiar with that as of Drake, I think. Let's get to this press release. So you've been right on the beat, on the vaccine apartheid beat, recently and covering it very well. There's been some movement this week since we reached out to you. And let's just read this. I'll put it up here so I don't have to turn my back to you guys while I do that. All right. This is from a statement from Ambassador Catherine Tai on the COVID-19 TRIPS waiver. This is a global health crisis, and the extraordinary circumstances of the COVID-19 pandemic call for extraordinary measures. And then I just think the emphasis is important here. The administration believes strongly in intellectual property, but in the service of ending this pandemic, supports the waiver of those protections for COVID-19 vaccines. We will actively participate in text-based negotiations with the World Trade Organization to make that happen, blah, blah, blah. So, Luke, are you happy now? Did you get everything? Is this everything you wanted?
I'm certainly pleasantly surprised. I was not expecting the announcement. It was just earlier this week that I was writing about Senator Chris Coons, who's a close ally of Biden, and a friend of Biden's. He was actually Biden's successor in the Senate in Delaware. And he basically pioneered this new argument, which was certainly was the kind of loudest exponent of it, about how the reason why there should be no waiver to these patents is actually because that could hand power to, you know, geopolitical adversaries, China in particular, he mentioned. So, you know, given kind of his proximity to Biden, given that it seemed like there was division in the administration on this, I mean, there were people telling the Washington Post, which has been reporting on this a lot, people from within the administration basically saying, you know, basically taking the right position that these patents needed to be shared. But there was clearly some division there. And when Chris Coons said that, I kind of thought, well, they're not really going to do this, are they? Because if they're, I mean, what was distinct about Chris Coons's argument was it was kind of stripping the sort of faux compassion that we'd heard from people defending the status quo so far. So you hear a lot of people who've said, well, property rights are not the problem. And if you waive these, you know, if you share patents, if you share vaccine recipes, it's not going to do anything to increase supply. It's not going to increase production. Chris Coons wasn't, as far as I could tell, really saying that. I mean, in the remarks he gave, he was kind of regurgitating a lot of those talking points, but he was, his real focus, and I think the subtext, if not the text of what he was saying, was basically, look, if we don't share this stuff, who cares? Because you know, America's exceptional, and we have a right to keep this stuff to ourselves. And so I was definitely pleasantly surprised by the announcement. I will say I think some of the Biden administration's other announcements should give us some pause here. There's a lot that's riding on the details. You know, what are they actually going to do? What does it mean that Germany, for example, is still going to oppose these kind of waivers at the World Trade Organization? Canada, which I'm very proud of, is currently still opposed and is going to, you know, play. Yeah, but I mean, Justin Trudeau getting outflanked on the left, even rhetorically by Joe Biden, should be considered a national shame up here, I would say. But so, yeah, there's a lot that's kind of still riding on this. And, you know, it's also the case that sharing vaccines, you know, there's a fellow I recently interviewed for Jacobin who's done great reporting, on patents, and the patent issue, Stephen Baranyi. And, you know, he was speaking to, the CEO of a small pharmaceutical company, in Canada, which says that basically they could produce over the next year, if they had the recipe, 20 million doses. And so from what I understand, and I'm by no means an expert on this, that kind of production capacity exists in a lot of places, but that on its own, just tapping that by sharing the patents, which, you know, we're still a ways from that. It's not clear what's going to come out of this announcement. But assuming that happens, there's more stuff that needs to happen. You know, during previous pandemics, there's been a more concerted effort to actually increase productive capacity. And when I spoke to Stephen, he gave me some examples of that. You know, private industry has no particular incentive, or really none at all, right, to you know, increase the productive capacity of these things when the factories and the manufacturing that gets built, it's just going to have to be dismantled after. That's not very profitable. But global governments, you know, and I mean, you know, something as powerful and well-funded as the United States federal government could do a lot to actively increase vaccine production by helping build that kind of capacity. So I don't know, that's just a, you know, that's just like a, I guess, a quick rundown of sort of where we're at and some of the ambiguity around this announcement, which is nonetheless pleasantly surprising and very good news.
Yeah. Can you just address, before we go any further, that the public ownership over, should rightfully have ownership over these, and this isn't, these aren't a product of the expertise of these pharmaceutical companies?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a huge thing. And I mean, it's not just that, you know, publicly funded research, you know, plays a role in these things. I mean, in the case of the AstraZeneca one, which I'm sure will come up later if we're talking about Bill Gates, I mean, that was developed at Oxford University. They're, you know, with each of these vaccines, which we now think of, you know, kind of exclusively in relation to these private companies and their brands, or more or less exclusively in relation to them, you know, the public sector, you'll find, has been involved somewhere. But there's another component to this, which is that, you know, pharmaceutical companies are not usually anyway in the business of committing, you know, large shares of their profits or investing a lot in research and development, because for the most part, it's kind of a high risk, low reward kind of thing. You can be very profitable shelling out like generic pharmaceutical drugs if you're the only one doing it. You know, if you have a monopoly, you can raise the prices, and there's not a whole lot people can do. But, you know, I don't know how current these numbers are, but I was watching an episode of the Dirty Money series that's on Netflix recently. You know, there were some statistics in there about how, you know, typical pharmaceutical companies will spend, you know, no more than a few percent of their operating budgets on research and development, because they don't want to take the risk. But what happens when there's a global pandemic, right? Governments step forward, just like the American federal government did roughly a year ago, and they basically said, you know, we're going to buy a ton of these doses, you know. And in some cases, you know, we're going to give money directly. There's going to be direct subsidies. It's very hard to believe, you know, pharmaceutical companies, like any, you know, like any private industry, they're not really in the business of doing things out of charity or compassion. They do things because they think they can make a profit. This research was not going to be, I mean, it was not going to be concluded, or, you know, as quickly as it has been, if there hadn't been all of this money from the American government, but also, you know, governments around the world. So the public sector, in addition to playing a very important role in the research behind these vaccines, also, I mean, effectively overrode or helped compensate for the inherent inefficiencies of the market when it comes to dealing with a pandemic. And it massively accelerated the research necessary to develop these vaccines by helping negate the risk that these companies were taking with all the stuff that they did, because they were basically just like, you know, here's a whole bunch of money. Your profits are going to be guaranteed in advance. So for people selling this story as like the triumph of the market or private industry, I mean, it's quite literally the inverse of that.
Yeah. And I think I want to get back towards the end of this and talk about these pharma companies. And you wrote a great piece in Jackman about how we need to start pushing back about the worship of the pharma companies and how this has been a really good PR operation for them. But before we get to that, we do have to talk about a little Bill Gates, because he's an interesting character and, you know, to cover, because he is somebody who has his fingers in so many nefarious things. A lot of them are not very well covered, Meanwhile, there's incredible amounts of conspiracy theories about Bill Gates. So I think it's important to be able to paint the picture that Bill Gates is bad, but not for the kind of conspiratorial reasons. Like, you don't need conspiracy theories. He's bad because he's a billionaire and he has too much influence. But back to the vaccine stuff, Bill Gates played a pretty leading role in trying to fight against these IP releases.
That's right. I mean, people want to read about this really in depth. There's a fantastic bit of journalism from Alexander Zaitchik. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. From last month in the New Republic. It's a really, really in-depth read. Another in-depth read on Bill Gates was just published in Current Affairs, co-written by Rob Larson and Nathan Robinson, which is kind of a bigger survey of Gates' career, which includes the patent issue. But I mean, the crux of this is that just over a year ago in April, Bill Gates decided for whatever reason that he was going to try to appoint himself global minister of health and have this kind of, and I'm not the first person to make that joke, but I mean, that really is, yeah. That really is the case. I mean, he set out to try to manage, as Alexander Zaitchik put it, the world's scientific response to the pandemic. And I mean, essentially what he did is he took a very, he took a very kind of generic idea of how the research and the distribution and all the rest of it, the process around the vaccine should be coordinated. That involved, as you'd expect, very rigorous protection of the property rights around these vaccines, which he's repeatedly said have absolutely nothing to do with, their distribution or supply, which is a talking point that the industry itself has really been kind of seeding for a long time. And you can go back and find, examples of it from the 90s and even from the more recent past. So what kind of got me into this was that Bill Gates did an interview on Sky News in Britain, and he basically he basically gave the most shameless version of this argument you could imagine. He said, he was asked by the interviewer, Sophie Ridge, if he thought that, loosening the patent restrictions, opening them up would be helpful, would help, create vaccines more quickly, distribute them more quickly, get more doses in people's arms. And don't forget, this is, as people know, this is all happening in a context where the vaccine is absolutely out of control in places like India. The virus is completely out of control. It'd be nice if the vaccine were completely out of control. The virus is completely out of control. I mean, not in Canada yet, but in Britain, in the United States, and some other kind of wealthier parts of the world, there's this feeling that normalcy is returning. That the pandemic is in some way over. That we're we're kind of in the, ninth inning or whatever. And by some projections, there are, countries in, the global south that are not going to see any kind of effective or widespread vaccination until 2023 at the earliest. So it is of the utmost importance with the, if the goal is to minimize the impact of the virus and save as many lives as possible, like increasing the supply, it's just a no-brainer. Anything that humanity as a whole can do, any cooperation that can be done to increase the supply seems like a no-brainer. Gates came on to Sky News. He responded to this question basically by saying, well, there's only so many vaccine factories in the world. And then he kind of concern trolled about the safety of the vaccines, suggesting that, these things can't be, some places don't have the expertise to manufacture them.
A horrible thing to be doing when you're trying to get everyone to take vaccines in general, to just cast doubt onto the safety of them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very unhelpful. And then he explicitly said, what's holding these things back is not related to intellectual property. He said, there's not some idle vaccine factory with regulatory approval that makes magically safe vaccines. So for one thing, that just isn't true. As I mentioned earlier, Steve Aronyi talked to this CEO, and there are other examples of this CEO in Canada who said that he's approached, their company's approached Johnson & Johnson, I believe, and I think one other pharmaceutical company and said, like, give us your recipe. We'll do 20 million doses of these things. This company, you know, definitely has the expertise to produce these things. But furthermore, as I mentioned already, you know, vaccine production effort, you know, can be support just like the research behind the vaccines and other aspects of kind of the vaccine process have been managed and or at least partly or invested in by governments. They can do the same thing with the production of the vaccines, not sharing the patents as a choice, not sharing the recipes as a choice, but so is minimizing the productive capacities necessary to you know create as many of these things as possible, so more people can be vaccinated. So, you know, Bill Gates has played, you know, probably as big or bigger a role than anyone in trying to make sure, you know, he helped talk Oxford, for example, which had initially said, you know, they'd mused about how they were going to basically put the rights to the vaccine they developed in the public domain. And Gates reportedly, according to Kaiser Health News, a report of theirs from a few months ago, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which incidentally, I don't know what that's going to be called now, but they stepped in, they stepped in and they basically got Oxford to reverse course and sign an exclusive agreement with AstraZeneca. So Bill Gates' role in this has been bad, to say the least.
Well, sorry, did you have something?
Well, I was just going to say, just really the tension between the imperatives of public health and profit. And I think with Steve Biryani, yeah, you had the good part of one of the articles about the knowledge sharing, I think, for penicillin during World War II.
Yes, that's right.
Because I feel like that's what we need to keep our eye on now, that they'll just, I feel like the minimum Biden's agreed to do is we will not allow lawsuits. But like this facilitating this knowledge transfer, I think, is a real key.
Yeah, and I mean, hopefully that's what happens. I mean, basically the story was, and I heard this, as you said, via Stephen, was, you know, during the Second World War, there was obviously a greater than usual need for antibiotics, and especially penicillin. And Pfizer was actually forced by the War Production Board to give up its recipe. And not only that, but the War Production Board shared the recipe with Pfizer's competitors. They gave the contracts to manufacturers and they built additional capacity so this stuff could be manufactured more quickly. And, you know, I've been reading up on this stuff a lot recently because of being on this beat, but from what I can tell, I mean, this, and from what Stephen told me, this, you know, this whole kind of conversation around intellectual property rights, you know, this, I mean, this would be considered a very strange, it'd be considered very strange that this is where we're at all, that we're even having this debate, you know, before the 1990s and before the World Trade Organization basically kind of embedded this particular way of thinking about intellectual property. To turn back to Gates for a second, I mean, he has reasons himself for defending this. His entire career, you know, much of his absolutely like unfathomable fortune, you know, owes itself to, you know, monopoly around particular patents and things like that, you know, vis-a-vis software and other things. And so, you know, of course he's defending the status quo in relation to this.
Yeah. And I want to like really dive into this point a little bit, because this really hits at why, you know, Bill, the title of this episode is Why Bill Gates is Not Good for the World, right? It's not just because some people misunderstand these criticisms that we make of Bill Gates. It's not just that we're saying Bill Gates is wrong. We're saying there's no reason that Bill Gates should be in this position to have this much influence over policy. Yeah. I found one of the most interesting things that's come up about this is this idea that Melinda was very much opposed to this. And this was like a big schism in causing the divorce. Because almost immediately after they announced the divorce, she went public and said they need to release the vaccine, which was wild. But that all being aside, like not even focusing on that, that's absurd even in itself, right? That the lovers quarrel between two super rich people
has
immense effects on public health.
Yeah, no, it's absurd. And I have to say, like, I do think, you know, there's a number of ways we can think about Gates's role in this. You know, I mean, it's, you know, we've been talking a lot in this discussion about kind of how, you know, private industry has this incentive because it wants to kind of guarantee its profits, you know, to protect the status quo around patent rights. And, you know, Gates, like I said, obviously there's an element of that as well. I mean, you know, he's invested in this system, but I think, and you know, owes, like I said, a lot of his fortune to exactly this kind of restrictive sort of monopoly system. But you know, I think when you're when you've risen to the top of global capitalism in the way that Bill Gates has, I think that your belief in his belief in the arguments that he's making transcends mere self-interest. You know, for pharma companies, their interest is a crude and profit-based one. I think Gates, there's certainly an element of that, but I think that he has kind of almost transcended that, and that his opposition to waiving the patent protection waiving the patents is, you know, is for intellectual and almost spiritual reasons. You know, something I am embarrassed to say I didn't know, which I learned from reading Robin Nathan's recent piece, is that Bill Gates lives in a mansion that is called Xanadu 2.0. Like seriously, like this is somebody who has like a deep, you know, deep investment in like capitalist excess at its most absurd, to the point where he can like unironically call his 66,000 square foot, $145 million mansion, Xanadu 2.0. Like somebody that's willing to do that is not, this guy's not just like a gatekeeper for like capital's, you know, immediate self-interest. Like he's a deep believer in this system. He's like a true, he's a true zealot. And I think that's kind of what we've seen
with a lot of resources to promote his zealotry.
Oh yeah. I mean, when I was reading through like, commentary on Bill Gates, like, you know, you find like good critical things people have written and like in left media and to some extent mainstream media as well. We also find stuff where it really reads like it was written by Bill Gates's PR department, like pieces where the headline is quite literally Bill Gates is trying to save the world. Is the world ready to listen? Like things like that.
Vox too.
But yeah, I mean, that's like a whole other thing about Bill Gates, right? Is like, I mean, he really is somebody who was, you know, from what I understand, he was considered like a greedy person. And then one time in kind of 1999 or 2000, he said, "Hey, I'm going to give all my money away." And he was reinvented overnight as like the world's most generous man. And he's so generous that his wealth has, I believe, quadrupled since he made that announcement about giving all his money away.
So I mean, it's hard when you're so talented.
I have this CBS News article from 2012 that I remember somebody posted on Twitter recently. At an Abu Dhabi media summit about running for president, he said his current job with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was, quote, a very nice office, and that it didn't require him to raise funds to try to get elected, nor does it have term limits of 8 years, as some elected offices. Yeah, so he just decided to buy stuff instead.
Also, like, it doesn't have term, like, he's relishing the fact. I mean, what's so amazing about a lot of, like, billionaires, especially the more, like, ideologically zealous ones, is they will just tell you what they think, right? Mm-hmm. It's like a lot of them are, you know, you can publicly find their extremely sinister musings about, like, population control or whatever. You know, I mean, right there, Bill Gates is basically basically insinuating that, you know, while my role is like global, it's like not like the mere US presidency. It's nothing as parochial as that. And furthermore, there's no term limits. There are no democratic checks, even nominal ones, on me at all. So I'm going to stay right where I am.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. They do just talk like that Bezos clip where he's like, "I don't really know what to spend all this money on except go into the space." We're human beings, guy.
No, and it's just like, you know, it's another great example of how charity and, you know, philanthropic organizations for these people end up, like, it's not just propaganda, as you were talking about earlier. It's like ways for them to flex their muscle. Bill Gates is able to get, you know, Oxford to not, you know, release IP on their research regarding the vaccine because he can say, "Hey, you see all this money that we're giving y'all? You know, we're going to cut this off." You know, and is why, like, one thing that we've covered a lot on the show has been very worrying how much farmland Bill Gates has been buying up around the country, because, you know, he's now the largest farm landowner in the U.S. because, you know, and he's talking about all these things that he wants to do environmentally for farm policy, and oh, it'll be so good. But as what I was,
capitalism innovating us back to feudalism, basically.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, literally.
You know, and I just, whenever I talk to people who are sort of on the fence or who don't identify themselves as socialists, I use Bill Gates as an example. Like, do you want somebody to have so much resources and so much power that he can just single-handedly, without, you know, essentially asking anybody, control the majority of farmland, usable farmland in the United States, for whatever purposes he wants to use those for?
Yeah, I mean, it is, billionaires are ultimately a democratic question. I mean, it's like, do we want to, because I mean, and I think one of the issues with billionaires, and why, you know, what a lot of people kind of misunderstand about them, is like $1 billion, let alone, you know, $100 billion, is a very difficult amount of money to fathom or picture. It's really not a question of these people. Like, I debated a libertarian in the last year. And I mean, you know, I feel like he was kind of making the argument or implying that, you know, somehow being a billionaire is just about like having more money, being able to buy more stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that might be the case of somebody who maybe has like $15 or $20 million, but it's not the case of having $1 billion, let alone the kinds of money that Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk mm-hmm. or people like that have. Like, no, as Bezos tells us, right? Like, nobody can spend that much money. What do I do with all this money? What you have at that point is control over like the levers of you know macroeconomic power. You know, you control the commanding heights of the, you know, American and also the global economy. You control investment decisions. You direct decisions mm-hmm. about huge amounts of our collective wealth are allocated, and you do that with absolutely no democratic, you know, check or involvement whatsoever.
I mean, the Bill Gates thing, you run a giant, you know, pilot study trying to convert to high stakes, like charter schools, high stakes testing charter schools. And then the RAND study does a study on it and says, actually, this failed miserably. And then you're just like, whoops, I guess this entire thing where my notions of what would be a good school, I guess that failed. And I just didn't listen to what school boards have to say. Yeah, I think it's a pretty intuitive message for people. It's amazing how Bill Gates comes up as an example in all these different stories.
I mean, because he's like, I mean, I don't know when, like, I remember when I was in high school, they included Bill Gates like in the curriculum.
Oh, yeah.
You know, of like, you know, as just like, oh, this is somebody to look up to. I remember watching like a documentary on Bill Gates, like, this is supposed to inspire y'all.
Yeah.
You know, I went to a very poor, like one of the poorest high schools in the country. And it was just an amazing, I remember just sitting there like, this is insane. Like, we share nothing in common with this person. And I didn't have the political consciousness that I do now, but yeah, I don't know. It's like, there's, and that wasn't accidental. That wasn't just a teacher one day waking up and saying like, you know what? I think the kids need to learn about Bill Gates. There's a whole operation that tries to bring this idea into schools.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it won't be, you know, it'll sound like a cliche to you guys and to your audience as well. But I mean, it's like billionaire philanthropy, especially the kind that Bill Gates has helped popularize, like really is one of the biggest kind of cons of, like, I don't know, the past 30 or 40 years, you know, where it's really, you know, this kind of philanthropy has really taken off. You know, actually, before I was kind of so immersed in thinking about Bill Gates on a weekly basis, I think just about 2 or 3 weeks ago, you know, I actually wrote this short piece about billionaire philanthropy, about this kind of literature review that some British academics put together, kind of reviewing all the literature on billionaire philanthropy. And I mean, it basically, you know, came to a series of familiar conclusions with some very convincing evidence. You know, the big one being that, I mean, you know, a lot of what we think of as charity, you know, you hear these huge sums of money, it really is just the cost of doing business if you're this mm-hmm. rich. It is, you know, you can purchase, I mean, there's hard power if you're rich, where you do a hostile takeover of a competitor or something like that. But there's also soft power, which you can get by, you know, creating a nonprofit that gives out grants, you know, and that has a charitable mission. You know, you can often even use your nonprofit stuff, your ostensibly charitable mission, as just another way of subsidizing your bigger mission, you know, your bigger competitive mission, and maximize your profits in the process, which is something that Bill Gates has certainly done. I mean, it really is a sham. It's not even, I mean, people point out, you know, things, I think this is worth pointing out too, that a lot of these billionaires that are called so generous, I mean, as a share of their income, what they give is actually not that generous at all. And in fact, people that make, you know, $50,000 a year in the United States, at least, I haven't seen the statistics elsewhere, but I think this is broadly true. You know, they're often much more generous in terms of like the share of what they give. And presumably when we talk about generosity, we mean, you know, that usually implies like giving something up, sacrifice. You're not really being generous if you're not giving something up. So I think that's important to register too, but it's not just the case that they're not as generous as they say. It's that a lot of what's considered generosity is just, you know, another type of, you know, market expenditure, really.
And yeah, I mean, it is something we could do a whole episode just on, like, that power dynamic. But in the last couple of minutes, I just wanted to shift it back to these vaccines, particularly the vaccine companies in the United States. And you wrote a piece in Jacobin basically lamenting this wide-ranging celebration of Big Pharma, which, as you noted in the piece, you know, just was it last year or a year before, was ranked amongst like one of the worst in public opinion industry. It's now skyrocketed up. You know, could you sort of walk us through why that's a problem and how they've been able to launder their image?
I just think it's very emblematic. I thought of this, I guess, a week or so ago because of something my girlfriend said to me, actually. And it occurred to me for the first time, like, just how emblematic it is of the, I don't know, the trajectory from, I don't know, the kind of language you would hear in maybe April of 2020, where this was going to be this like wartime style effort, unprecedented cooperation, vaccines for all, people's vaccine. We went from that really without anybody noticing, I think, until recently, thanks to all the activism around the patent issue. You know, really without even noticing, we kind of went, you know, we arrived at a point where the market had completely devoured the global vaccine response. And I think there's, you know, I mean, I don't need to let, we've already talked about all the ways that that's happened, but I think like something that's very emblematic of that is you know, that when we think of vaccines now, we think of them in relation to these, you know, these brands, these specific brands. It's, you know, and in the piece, like, I talk about, you know, what's happened with Kleenex, which, you know, Kleenex, I ended up, I mean, it's just like one of those funny things about like having to write a piece every day is you end up learning a lot of random facts. And with this piece, that was certainly the case. Like, I learned that, you know, Kleenex was registered not as a facial tissue, but as something else in 1924. But it was so successful that it kind of took off, and eventually just the Kleenex brand. Like, when you say Kleenex now, you don't think of a trademark. You know, it's not like saying iPhone or something, really, or I don't know. There might be a better example, but
Sharpie's another one like that too, right?
Podcast. Right. Kleenex just like subsumed the actual product, even though I couldn't find recent numbers, but Kleenex doesn't have a majority market share, just a very generous one. And it's like, that probably doesn't matter when we're talking about Kleenex, right? It's like, I don't really care. I'm not like socializing Kleenex. It's not like high up on my list of like political priorities, but it absolutely does matter if we're talking about like life-saving vaccines that are the only protection against a deadly virus. I think the fact that, like, you know, these companies have just like pulled off this PR coup is like it's very emblematic of this kind of wider global failure.
And I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this, but one thing that I think gets lost with some folks who might not consider themselves to be socialists when they hear us complaining about Big Pharma and Pfizer and these companies, well, they're sitting here and saying like, well, of course people are celebrating them because we're living in a pandemic and they gave us a vaccine. But what we're seeing is, one, no, they really didn't. We're trying to divorce that. And two, we absolutely celebrate the potential of, like, you know, of scientists and researchers and people who are developing this. We support that process very much so, actually to such an extent that what we're saying here is to protect the brand, right? You actually have to prevent there to be global collaboration on virus research, on vaccine research. And then you have to have actual, you have to have control over the distribution of the vaccine system too, instead of making it accessible to all. We're not saying we don't celebrate somebody who was spending, you know, days and days on days trying to figure out how to deal with the virus. We're saying there's this big monster that's sitting on top of that process that's making it less efficient, and is now reaping incredible profit at the expense of all of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think one of the reasons why, you know, in that statement that Matt, you read off the top from the Biden administration, you know, they're very clear that they're like, look, we support property, you know, rights. We're not, we're, this is just like an emergency thing. You know, you can see, you know, there's an immediate panic on the markets yesterday after this announcement. These shares absolutely plummeted. And I think that's because there's a recognition now. And I mean, this would have actually surprised me 3 weeks ago. And I'm, you know, it's another one of those like being pleasantly surprised type of things. You know, it would have surprised me that, you know, the reputation of these companies, or at least the kind of status quo they were protecting could, you know, potentially like fall in people's estimation so so quickly. And I think they now realize that there actually is a tremendous risk here, because you know, I saw somebody tweet earlier today. I saw because Naomi Klein retweeted it. You know, somebody was saying like, let's do the same thing with, you know, sharing the patents around green technology, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you can think of so many other cases where there's just an immediate intuitive and like pretty much irrefutable case for cooperating, for sharing scientific knowledge. And, you know, the profiteers, the monopolists of private industry, and their political apologists, I think, really recognize the threat that something like this poses to their way of doing business and to their entire model. Because what COVID has done is expose their entire model as a sham, as monopoly, as profiteering, and as inefficient if the criteria that's centered is, you know, there's a pandemic, and so our goal should be to eradicate the pandemic as quickly as possible. The market doesn't have a solution to that. In fact, it's an albatross around the neck of, you know, cooperation in the interest of ending the virus as soon as possible.
And just one final point, even on the branding note, and the knowledge transfer thing, there's nothing to say that Pfizer couldn't teach something to AstraZeneca or Moderna, right? Like, we had all this knowledge. Maybe these vaccines could be even better. But Luke Savage, you can find him at Luke W. Savage on Twitter. Anything you want to plug tonight, Luke?
Oh, I guess I might as well plug my own podcast, Michael and Us. It's like a current events podcast, but also like a film and TV podcast. So a bit of everything. People who like this podcast will probably like it. So check it out.
Michael and Us, folks. We're going to take a quick break, David, I think, and we'll be back in a little bit. Thanks very much, Luke.
Cheers, guys.
And we are back. That was a great talk with Luke. He's a very smart guy on these issues and covering that well.
It's definitely fun. I've been reading Luke for a few years now. So I was reading Luke before, you know, I met Michael and was doing this. It's always fun to bump into folks like that.
Yeah, so we have some bad news to cover, David. First of all, let's do the pitch.
Before we do the bad news, and we're also going to be doing a lot of more positive news in the post game. So definitely consider joining us at patreon.com/leftreckoning. We really appreciate all the support that we've gone over these past few months. I just want people to know so they don't think it's like a 2-for-1 thing. Matt and I are no longer associated with TMBS, so we don't get anything from that Patreon, so that doesn't support the work here. So if you do like this show and you want to support the work that we're doing here at Left Reckoning, please consider supporting us at patreon.com/leftreckoning. You get the main show, you get the post games immediately after, you get the theory readings, and then we're also doing extra episodes.
I just want to cut in now. We are going to do a Discord viewing of Hillbilly Elegy, I think.
Yes.
For one. So that's coming up for patrons.
That's in the pipeline. We also have, if you missed it, the conversation that we had with Milton Alamadi recently on Walter Rodney, I figure is one of the better ones that we've had so far. We've also talked to Paul O'Connell about James Connolly. You know, a lot of great stuff that you're missing out on. If you're only watching this main show, you're missing out a lot more of these more in-depth conversations that we're having out there.
Did you see, patrons would have been prepared for the first quote in Jacobin?
Hell yeah.
Jacobin, a James Connolly quote.
No, we're really trying to take a deep dive into a lot of these thinkers with people whose work and life and politics have been influenced, and to try to take these kind of questions and these thinkers from kind of like stale academic conversations into practical ones that can affect your organizing, your political perspective, and things like that. It's a big part and you know, goal of this show is to provide a very accessible and fun political education. And we try to do a lot of that on the main show for everybody, but you really get 2-for-1 on the Patreon. So definitely consider subscribing to that.
Yeah, were we talking about workplace? I had a really good conversation about our workplace. I feel like one post game. Maybe it was last week or the week before, but like getting one over your boss, stealing leisure at work, like those types of different conversations. So,
Oh yeah. Last week, Matt and I were going, or was it last week or the week before, where we were talking about our favorite jobs?
Yeah, jobs where the boss wasn't there.
No, yeah, exactly. Matt and I went through the best workplaces we've ever worked in, which were all places where the bosses were extremely absent. we have fun, hang out, drink a couple beers, and you know the post games are very much relaxed. And then these extra shows are fun too, but they're a little bit more on the nose. I think just because we got knocked out with our shots, we weren't able to get one that will come up on Sunday, but we'll release a think tank on Monday, we're thinking. We'll keep everybody updated on that. But anyways, enough for the pitch. I need to talk about what happened in Austin with this most recent vote. I'm going to focus on Prop B. There's a lot of different initiatives that were there, some good, some bad. I don't have too much when it comes to hot takes on these things. I don't really think that it's very productive, but I think it's worth covering just because we spent a lot of time promoting the fight against Prop B. For folks who aren't familiar with this, Prop B was an initiative that was put forward by an organization called Save Austin Now, which presented itself as a bipartisan organization, but was a brainchild of the Travis County, the county that Austin is in, GOP. Again, they presented themselves as a bipartisan organization, but their office just happened to be in the county GOP office building. They put forward Prop B, which is an extreme anti-homeless bill. And for folks who aren't familiar, Austin decriminalized homeless, and also as part of the protests last summer, were able to defund the police with portions of that money going to housing folks, right? This Prop B is extreme in its cruelty. Not only is it coming after the camps, it essentially makes being homeless illegal, makes people face high fines and penalties which again, if you're somebody who's homeless, the idea that you're going to be able to pay these is ludicrous. I believe May 11th is when we're going to start seeing some of these camps being cleared out by the police. And I know people are organizing to try to help folks out and prevent, you know, the worst of these calamities. But it was a huge, huge, huge loss. And it was really devastating. I want to say, you know, shout out to all of the people and organizers, people who were donating, people who were making calls, knocking on doors. It was really important work. And it's a fight that's worth happening, you know, participating in, even if you lose, right? Because it's a really long struggle, and there is no final victory. There is no final defeat. But I just wanted to go through just a couple things to explain what happened. One, the Texas GOP saw a huge opportunity here to overturn a progressive move in the city, which was if they could get something on the ballot in May, which is a low turnout election, that they would be much more likely to win. They also figured that the groups that had fought for decriminalization in the first place might not be as prepared to prevent this kind of move. And they were successful in raising like $1.7 million. For people who don't follow politics closely, or people who might be from like huge cities like New York, you just have to understand that that's an insane amount of money to put forward something for a ballot measure, right? Just absurd. And the inundation of, you know, anti-homeless messaging, Prop B messaging in the city of Austin was palpable. I mean, I got like five or six mailers. When I turned into my house, there's a huge ass billboard. They were doing all of these really despicable ads, with all kind of like, you know, that really nasty, cruel, like you feel like you're just being psychologically induced to think a certain way with like scary horror music, stuff like that. Anyways, they had everything that you need to win. You have a state government that is willing to support you like crazy. You have big finance behind you. You have the real estate lobby behind you. And you have an army of, GOP operatives and also some, blue dog Democrats, who are willing to lie and cheat and mislead people. So this deck is stacked against folks. And again, I salute to all the people who are doing this work. I think in the analysis, I think the biggest lesson is that this is an uphill battle. Homelessness is a huge problem in Austin, as in it is everywhere in the country. And what people and progressives have been trying to do here has been trying to prevent the cruelty of police, brutality and harassment against folks while working to house people. I want people to know, especially people who might be feeling down, just because they were able to get this through does not mean the fight to house people is over. Matt, if you could go to the second link, I just want to remind people again, the issue of homelessness is big. So this is not enough. And just in the sense, it's like what we have to do is a lot bigger than this, but there's still movement. Matt, could you read it? Because it's just not on for me, just the title.
Yeah, this is Austin City Council panel advances plan of housing 3,000 homeless in 3 years. The Austin City Council Housing and Planning Committee voted on Monday to advance the plan. Housing 3,000 people experiencing homelessness over the next 3 years, a plan that emerged from a homelessness summit in April. The vote comes 2 days after Austin voters chose to reinstate the city's public camping ban and would still need to be approved by the full council on May 20th.
So I bring that up again, not to say that things are grand, but I'm just saying that, the defeat is big, but it doesn't mean that the momentum has to go away on this issue. The second point is a little bit nuts and bolts politics. First of all, a lot of people have been focusing on that. If you could pull up the map real quick, Matt. Mm-hmm. This is the map of the vote where you're seeing the western parts of Austin voted in support of Prop B, while the more central and eastern parts voted no. For people who aren't familiar with Austin, this is very much, you put this map on a map of, household income, you're going to see a lot of correlation between these things. The western part of the city is a lot wider and it's a lot wealthier than other parts of the city. And that's a huge factor in how people voted. You can put it down too. But it's not all. One was that the early votes very much favored Prop B. So all of the work that was being done on the ground actually did make a huge impact. The totals for people who voted the day of were much more against Prop B than the early votes, but it just shows the huge advantage that the opponents had. The other thing too, though, that has to be noted, and this might be the thing that we zoom out from just Austin in particular, is that Austin's a city that, you know, presents itself as very progressive. Austin is a city that had a lot of Bernie Sanders voters, right? And you know, one of the difficult histories of this town, as it is with a lot of these other progressive towns, is matching the image up to the reality. And people are really fighting to make the image, you know, the reality match the image there. But the reality is here is that making alliances, even if we can convince people on certain issues, with the hyper rich out there, even if we can convince them to vote progressive from time to time, it's not a panacea, because the only thing that's going to help us win is building strong working class movements. Because if we put ourselves at the whims of, for example, these kind of votes tend to be whiter, they tend to be wealthier. This is why the GOP targets this kind of, you know, this kind of vote here for their initiatives, because they know that they're going to have more success. Even if the people might identify as Democrat or progressive, if you start threatening people's property values and things like that, you'll see a very ugly side come out very quickly. So again, there's no real hot takes here. This is just sort of, here's what happened. It's a devastating loss. Oh, and just one other thing, and I didn't have anything prepared on this, but it's amazing to see some of the coverage over the past few days where they're actually interviewing houseless folks, people experiencing homelessness, mm-hmm. In their own words, which was something that was sorely lacking from a lot of, you know, local news publications in the going into the election, right? It was interviews with man on the street or drive out to Westlake or, you know, a wealthy neighbor to talk to people what they think about the camping ban, and not enough talking to people who are actually saying, this will severely negatively impact me. I don't have anywhere else to go. I need a solution. You know, I don't know. That's another thing, but there's a reason for that. It's because the cards were stacked in a certain direction from the get-go on this question.
Yeah. Money. I mean, we'll talk more about, not Republicans, but, moderate Democrats in, San Francisco. That, yeah, they're not allies when it comes to the class questions of like raising taxes or dealing with homelessness for people in a country that has multiples vacant homes for every single person that doesn't have a house. And that's because we decide that those things are more important as assets than as things to shelter human beings with.
That's the end goal. That's the, you know, the end of the story is that these crises happen because you're having, you know, in Austin, it's everywhere in the United States. We've the explosion in asset prices for homes is in the interests of the wealthy and the elite in the society. It's not in the interests of housing people, everyday people, right? The fact that you look at what you can get for $400,000 in the city or hell, cities all across the town, and you see that that's extremely modest and by many people's standards, small house, only goes to show that these markets are completely out of whack with human need, and they get purposefully developed that way, right, to maximize profits for people who are already landholders and, you know, property owners. And when you have a system that is so skewed towards that, you are going to have housing crisis. You're going to have homelessness. This is not just like homelessness is not just some kind of like natural reality of society. It's very, very clearly a policy choice and a choice of what economic system that we live under. The fight against that economic system is not going to be one that's going to win overnight. So any kind of small victory we can get over it is really important. But we have to just remember that there is no real solution to this as long as we have, a system that is more focused on inflating asset prices for smaller property holders than for housing people who desperately need homes.
Did you see the Caitlyn Jenner?
That's a great example.
Saying that that her neighbor at the plane hangar told her that I can't stand to continue looking at homeless people, so I'm going to move to Sedona, which is one solution to the homeless problem. I guess just move to Sedona.
And it's like, and that's another thing too, is it's just like, it's such a rich person attitude that's like, oh, I just don't want to see homeless people, which is something that the Prop B people leaned very, very hard into.
Yep.
And it's, you know, it's disgusting. It should be disgusting. You don't have to experience this personally. Like, I've been homeless before. I know what that feels like. And it's not a position that anybody really wants to be in. It's a position where people are typically trying to find a way out. And if we don't give people solutions or opportunities to do that, for fuck's sake, just don't like send the police after them to harass them in the meantime. It's just cruelty to the max there.
Yeah, it's just like you asked, what should these people do? And the answer is, I don't know, but not here. And
yeah, really, no, I mean, that's exactly what it is. And I will also just note one like quick thing. I know this has sort of been all over the place, but you know, one thing, like when there was the big storm here, right? And people were, you know, freezing to death. Knowing where people were was immensely helpful in getting people who are experiencing homeless into shelters so that they could be warm during that experience. What is, if that were to happen, you know, in this post, you know, camping ban reality, right? That means people will freeze to death because people will be out in the woods, in the country, in a creek, right? Where they're not going to be found. Right, at least right now, as difficult, you know, as these, you know, the communities can be, right? At least you know where people are so that you can provide them with social services and you can provide them with help in moments where they desperately need it. And just dispersing the population like this is going to have a human cost. And we should never forget the actual, what's actually at stake for these things. These aren't just political positions that you win or lose. Like, these are life or death questions for people.
Yeah.
Well, anyways, sorry, that's a tough one, but there's no really great way to sugarcoat that. But, you know, I think it's important to remember the fight continues and, you know, there's no, as the line goes, no final victories, no final defeats, you know, keep riding on. Join us in the post game in a little bit and we'll talk about some positive news elsewhere in the world and keep that inspiration flowing.
All right, folks, we will see you patrons probably a little bit before 10 p.m. Tonight, and the rest of you, peace out.